Today's program is proudly brought to you by Culture City, a for-purpose organization that provides a place of acceptance and support for all autism families. For more information, visit culturecity.org.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
What? This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And I have a very special guest today. Sadly, he's not in the studio because it'd be so much more fun if he were. But I will be talking today with John Wilkes. John is also a host here on Heritage Radio Network, but he has many other hats. He was, of course, raised in the English county of Shropshire. And you will forgive me if I burst into a sort of fruity, fake British accent at various points during the broadcast. I just won't be able to help myself, I can tell already. Anyway, grew up on a farm in Shropshire, and at around 20, he took over the farm, adapting to changing market trends. I'm reading his bio, replacing older United Kingdom heritage animals with continental European breeds of cattle and sheep. That's a no-no. And then moving away from the land, he moved to Cornwall, a lovely area, and launched a property development business, followed by owning and operating an award-winning fish and chips restaurant, a chip shop, John. And then most recently, he moved to the U.S. a few years ago, and of course, that's where I met him, right here at Heritage. And through extensive U.S. travel and farm visits, has gained a unique perspective on the USA and European farming styles and food production. And today, his focus is consulting, speaking, writing, and broadcasting with his own radio show on Heritage Radio Network, which is known as The Whole Shebang. He's also a board member of the Livestock Conservancy. Is that different from the American Livestock Breed Conservancy? We will talk about that. And most recently, John has launched a customized gourmet agri-travel tours to the United Kingdom. And I'm expecting a freebie on that. Welcome to the show, John. Thanks a lot for joining me today.
Thank you. Cool, blimey, Mary Poppins. You're doing a very good accent there. Oh, stone me. You know
Scare
what I mean?
Me.
Anyway, yes. No, well, thank you for that flattering introduction.
Oh, I did my best. So, John, let's get busy with the actual show, and then I'm sure we will have many digressions along the way.
Digress
is always good. And you were in a previous life, obviously. Like me, you seem to change careers about every 10 years, I notice.
Yes.
And we'll have to discuss that over a pint at some other date. But you were a sheep farmer in your seminal formative years. And tell us about what the differences that are between how animal agriculture works here versus how it works in the UK. Like, what are the biggest differences that you see?
Well, I think on the sheep side of things, which was my forte, I used to run several hundred breeding sheep, producing lambs for the eating market as opposed to the wool market. I think in relation to the sheep side of things, there's far more organization within the UK. It's a big job for us. We're a country 75 times smaller. We have 34 million sheep in the US.
Wow.
It's a lot bigger, and you've only got 5.3 or whatever it is. So for us, a big industry, and export-led, and so 30% of all exports go to Europe and beyond. So for us, the difference is, I think in the UK, the sheep industry I can speak about, there's a lot more people heading in the same direction. There's less sort of regional variations. People are very focused on the product, on whether you're farming in England, Scotland, Wales, or wherever, that the product you're producing, the lambs you're producing, are pretty much the same in relation to how they look, the shape of the animals, the meat they carry, and also the fat cover on them.
Uh-huh.
So the industry in the UK, I'll get shot down by my mates at the American Sheep Industry Association, but we're very focused on the quality of the product, and I think that's one of the most striking differences that I found. Having said that, the American sheep industry is making great strides to improve on the product. So, that's one of the big ones.
So what is the difference? Is it the breed? Is it the genetics, or is it the feed, or is it the style in which the animals are raised? I imagine the UK primarily pasture-based I don't know if that's true in the United States. I really know nothing about the sheep industry in this country because, as you point out, it's quite small.
Yeah, we don't want to get bogged down too much on the sheep thing. Basically, in the UK, nearly all the little woolly darlings are grass-fed. And also, our breeds tend to be smaller and meatier. I mean, the average carcass size of a lamb in the U.S. is something like 74 kilos. I mean, it's
125 pounds. Roughly, yeah, give or take. 135, I guess.
Sorry, 34 kilos, which is like times 2.2. So what's that? About 70 pounds.
Right.
In the UK, the average carcass is 50. Our animals tend to be shorter and meatier. That's the thing. And not so big.
And maybe that's why Americans don't really eat a lot of lamb, because most of the lamb we eat in this country is either New Zealand or Australian, not so much American lamb, although I know they're trying hard, struggling manfully to make inroads into the market. But let's move on to like when you've traveled around the United States looking at farms, what shocks you the most about how we raise livestock? And is there any similarity between what you do in the UK or EU? That is European Union, or is it all just a completely night and day difference?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a shocking difference. I mean, I can sit down with farmers wherever I am, you know, in Western Europe or here, and everybody, we're kind of sons of the soil. You have this close affinity. I think there is definitely there's a basic difference on meat production, in that in the U.S., you're far more likely to embrace, shall we say, newer technologies, and you can say whether they're right or wrong, you know, steroids and hormones and the various things that can go into pig meat.
Yeah.
So that's something which, you know, we don't go in for. Steroids and hormones are banned in the UK.
All hormones and all steroids.
Pretty well, yeah.
Wow.
We're steroid and hormone free across all our meat sectors, pretty well. But I mean, I'm not going to knock the American industry. The American farmers are very efficient, and I think that we can learn. You know, I think it's about learning from both sides. I mean, we do get accused. I mean, just recently, I had a conversation with a senior bloke in the National Pork Producers Council who gave it me chapter and verse that Europe was basically sort of, you know, sinking into a scene from Monty Python's Search for the Holy Grail, where we all go around eating mud. And, we kind of flog each other with big sticks, and that's all we do. But it was a little more, obviously, politely put than that.
I've never actually observed that in the U.S.
Where I live, it happens all the time. It's a local sport.
Eat the mud. Flogging and eating mud.
In August there is the Shropshire Mud Eating Competition.
Oh my God! Is that part of the new business of agrotourism that you're launching? It's certainly a gourmet product, no question.
It's Shropshire
mud.
It's expensive mud, and it's nice mud. But no, the idea that we're lagging behind, and I mean, in relation to the GMO thing. I mean, in the UK, I think there is more movement towards it from particularly from the cropping side of things, because of the need to increase production, and certain elements of GMO will allow you to cut costs and cut fertilizer and pesticide use.
A few years, yeah.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's, you know, all hell breaks loose in your fields, as has been repeatedly pointed out, to no avail. I do want to take issue for a second. I read today at in the excellent Ag Insider, published by the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, which has recently started charging an inordinate amount of money for their articles, which I feel sad about, but nevertheless. I know, right? The nerve of them trying to make a living. They quoted a study by the USDA that showed that the pork industry has consolidated over the last two decades, and there are virtually no, you know, comparatively speaking, almost no independent pork producers. It's all run by either contract growers who are in servitude to the big producers, or it's just a little niche market like the Nyman Ranch folks. You know, it's and also the other thing about I wanted to say about the GMO that you referenced, that it, you know, Europe has made a great point of not growing any GMO crops. And yet, as I learned recently in my research for my weighty 45,000 word tome,
which makes me very excited. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to write it because right now I'm experiencing such intense panic that I really can't quite do almost anything. But
strong drink.
Yeah, I think that must be it. I think that's a really good idea, actually, John. But I was surprised to see, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in the second half of the show when we talked about the transatlantic trade and. Otherwise known as TTIP, Trade and Investment Partnership. But they have no problem importing GMO crops to feed their livestock, but they don't actually want to grow them there. That's an aside. Anyway, let us move on, because one of the things you and I have talked about quite often is, you know, sort of the groups like PETA and Humane Society of the United States and Mercy for Animals. And and they're, you know, they publicize all these animal cruelty issues. And I know that you have strong feelings about this, and don't hold back, please. What are the problems that you take most issue with in terms of, like, just ordinary, these are livestock practices, they've been going on forever.
Yep.
So, like, what's the big deal? And why are you trying to make the meat industry look bad? That, I mean, that's essentially what I'm asking. I'm asking, what is it about those
organizations?
I think
without naming names, I think that they take very often isolated examples, which then are magnified into to become major examples. I mean, if we take, for example, the PETA, or was it PATA? I never.
PETA.
That's it. Thank you.
PETA.
Don't be disrespectful. The shearing issue. There was indeed a fairly grim video which they launched on their website of conditions in a, I think it was an Australian shearing shed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not pretty, and it isn't good looking.
Why wasn't it pretty?
Because the kind of level of abuse and what the guys were doing to the sheep as they were shearing them and using the handpiece, which, as you can imagine, is a cutting tool.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff, it wasn't good. But, okay, in any industry, you're going to have bad people and you're going to have good people. And the only hope is that there is an awful lot more good people than bad people. And at the end of the day, I think these organizations, these animal welfare organizations, there is a big goal, and their big goal is to basically stop us eating animals. And whether it's wrapped up as animal welfare as a way of achieving it is a moot point. And that's why I find it a little bit rubs against the grain that often the other side isn't put because it doesn't go viral. You know, the chance for people to sort of reply to these viral vids, which I gather these kids, some of these videos that are shot for these animal welfare folk, that you can earn about $800 a week plus expenses to go and pretend to work for somebody for a week, and then you shoot a bit of film and then you clear off.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, I can understand that they do a lot of good and they highlight some inhumane practice, but I do feel that for all the bad stuff that they feature, there is a huge amount. American livestock farmers, UK, European livestock farmers are a good bunch of people. And if you maltreat your animals, you don't make any, you know, you don't make any money. You need to be efficient and you need to look after your animals. And I think that's one of my biggest bugbears.
Yeah. No, I don't blame you. I mean, I think, although I will take issue with the fact that that the whole goal is to make us stop eating meat. That may be true of PETA and Mercy for Animals, but the Humane Society of the United States and indeed around the world, it's really about treating animals correctly. So I don't feel that they should be tarred.
How many vegetarians are at the head of these organizations if you Google a bit?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, what if I were a vegetarian? I mean, I don't think that's relevant, actually.
I am not knocking vegetarianism. What I'm saying is the people that are, some of the people, inverted commas, that are at the tips of these organizations are basically often vegetarian, vegan. I mean, it's like in the UK. Here's a doozy.
Okay, tell.
We've got, as you know, we've had a bit of a shake-up in the political system, and we've now got our shadow government, which is these are the guys who aren't in power, the Labour Party, traditional party of the people.
Yeah.
So we've now got this radical Trotskyist guy who's taken over the helm as leader of the opposition. So
is that the guy who's being compared to Bernie Sanders?
Colonel Sanders, maybe. I don't know. But no. yes, possibly. He's this kind Marxist guy, and he is brought in as his shadow agriculture, basically, minister. A vegan, vegetarian.
Yeah.
And can you imagine if you're a UK farmer, the message that sends out to you when the head of your, you know, shadow political party elects a vegan as head of farming. Anyway, so it's not just here. That's what I'm trying to say is that this is, I think there's a lot of this going on.
Well, okay. I mean, I'll leave that for you. I guess what I was trying to get at is that a lot of times these videos that go out are showing things that many farmers think of as just standard operating procedure.
Right.
And that are not considered cruel, like tail docking, for instance. You know, they cut off tails because otherwise animals might bite them off.
Oh, yeah, and teeth grinding and all that.
And teeth grinding and debeaking. And, you know, like some of those things, I guess, from the point of view of the farmer, make a lot of sense. And from the point of view of the consumer and or viewer, seem like really abhorrent.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I mean, I'm not here to defend big ag in any way, shape or form, but... Mm-hmm. You know, the people have to be fed, and you know, sometimes there's quite a bit of inverted commas specialness that comes around, you know, sort of meat and how it's produced, and people that are in a position to be able to afford to buy a, you know, a chicken that's a bit special or a piece of pork that's had a happy life running around a field. But a lot of people can't afford it, and I know systems can change to basically produce animals like that. But when, I mean, if you travel in North Carolina and you go into, I've done it myself, you travel out to the coast across eastern North Carolina, there are just mile upon mile of, you know, sheds producing pigs that end up in Walmart.
Yeah.
To feed the folk. So it's a tricky one. I don't think it's one that's ever going to get really answered. And I don't know. What do you think?
What I think is that I think in particular pork production has gone over to the dark side in a way that I find quite alarming, as poultry production has been for quite some time. And I think there are much better ways of producing large volumes of animals that do not include whether you want to call them inhumane practices or not. Just the idea that an animal spends its entire life inside a shed is pretty disturbing. And
I can't
imagine that it really, like, however carefully you doctor up its feed with whatever drugs or even whatever, you know, products you're using, whether it's corn or soy, alfalfa, you know, all of the various grains and cereals that go into livestock feed. However well you manage that, you are still not producing a pig that tastes as good as a pig that grows up outside.
No, I hear that entirely, and the reason I got into one with this guy who'll remain nameless, who's probably...
Oh, no, do tell.
Well, he's I think he's the lead lobby.
It's not Steve, right? Steve Gerritsen or whatever?
No.
Okay.
No, this was another gentleman. Anyway, it was about something else in relation to BBC. Might have been interested in some stuff in relation to BBC.
It was a lobbying issue, right?
Yeah, around the lobbying thing. So I got it, you know, and, you know, it's... So I took the rant for quite a while, and I sat there like a brick, very stoic, stiff upper lip.
Yeah.
You know, I was, you know, sort of I could hear the queen in the background singing. And but after a bit, what I pointed out to him is that Chipotle have recently, you know, there was a bit of a carnitas famine in Chipotle a few months
ago. Yeah, I actually did a show about it, yeah. It went on for quite a while.
Because they couldn't get enough pork that met their fairly strict welfare standards.
Right.
Well, of late, fairly recently, Chipotle have just signed a multi-million-dollar contract with a UK company based up on Humberside in the UK called Caro Food Products, to basically who have the pig production systems on a large scale that meet Chipotle's exacting standards.
Really?
So, of course, when I hit this gentleman with that, it's a great line. You'll love this. These guys, you know, 20 years on the hill, you know what I mean? And nothing fazes me, yada, yada. So, anyway, I hit him with that, and in fairness, he only went quiet for 3 seconds before, and I kid you not, he said to me, Chipotle, they won't be here in 10 years' time. And I felt like going, woo, that's a bit of a rash one, but anyway, there we go.
Yeah.
So there is, you know, this group on Humberside have farmer producers that supply them, and they're able to produce the pork which meets Chipotle's needs. Which, I mean, now Neiman Ranch is, you know, they're also supplying them, and I think that with their latest takeover, they probably will look to, I would imagine, to ramp up production. Maybe.
Indeed. But, yeah, the whole point of getting involved with Purdue, which, you know, sent shivers of horror down the spine of every progressive foodie, I hate that term, every progressive food advocate around the country. But the fact is that Purdue is going to offer them a lot in terms of research and development money, in terms of streamlining their distribution systems and so forth. I mean, I listened to a very interesting, shall we say, sales pitch on the part of both Jeff Trepesian, who's their VP of sales, and also Jim Purdue, talking about what Purdue is going to offer Niman Ranch, and how it's going to, you know, help them rather than harm them. And I'm hoping that other companies start feeling. I mean, your friend at the National Pork Producers Council is very similar to the guy that I had a run-in with. I was invited on a pork crawl last year, and I had the nerve to bring up to him the issue of antibiotics in livestock, and he literally told me that I was insane. Right. And that I didn't know what I was talking about, which, you know, may well be true, but I, you know, both of those may be true. But the fact is that he's sort of missing the point, which is what consumers want is what consumers are going to get eventually. And, you know, these people who ignore the role of the consumer in how livestock is raised and processed in this country, I think do so at their peril. So I think the National Pork Producers Council is going to have a real comeuppance in the not too distant future. We're like already running out of time because I'm jabbering here. Let me ask you this, John, and then we're going to take a break, and then we'll talk about the TTIP or TTIP, as it's called.
And TPPP and PTT.
Yeah, I know, right? So you said earlier that you saw European Union practices beginning to align more with U.S. style, which is kind of alarming, because European Union, U.K. in particular, is still pretty much all small freeholders who feed into a larger business, right, into a larger distribution.
Yeah. I mean, the chicken job in the U.K., I mean, Cargill's are in now. A lot of friends of mine are investing multi-million pounds into, you know, the chicken job.
Into the big chicken houses?
Yep. Oh, it's huge. With my area in Shropshire, Herefordshire now, there are, multi-million sheds going in.
Wow. And they haven't obviously read Chris Leonard's book, The Meat Racket, or they would know that that was really a dumb investment.
Most of them can't read.
They're not going to thank you for that, laddie.
No, they will. They'll be fine. You've got to get your accent right a bit.
Really? It's not that good?
No, that was more like sort of, you know, southern, above the estuary, Essex, they call that.
Oh, really? Because, you know, I lived in London for a year, so that's pretty much what I base my,
You can get therapy for that now.
Yeah. how much do you think these big agribusinesses, I mean, having just told me that that some of the big players are moving in and your people, your farm friends are buying into the sort of the American system, how much do you think agribusiness is affecting your government policy towards agriculture?
I think we'll come on to it in a bit, but I mean, so policy-wise, I think in relation to the TTIP, our government would love it. You know, they would welcome. I was talking to a guy who's fairly high up in the UK meat export side of things, and he said that, you know, the basically Whitehall government are behind it, but it's again, as we'll talk about, it's the people and the image that they've got to try and sort out to nail a deal with these talks. So it's. I mean, a lot of my friends are farming incredibly high-tech with the arable, with the cropping side of things now. It's all minimal cultivation, min-till, and they are using biotechnology, and it's all satellite-driven, and it's pretty spectacular now, that side of it. So, but they're not, so production-wise, they've always been good producers, and I think they're looking to try and take technology. Some big producers would like to take even more technology to improve their margins.
Sure. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I have no quarrel with technology, especially if it helps you retain soil and do a better job. Let's take a quick break right now for a sponsor drop, and then we'll be right back with John Wilkes, a former Shropshire lad.
A Shropshire boy.
Yep. And we'll talk more about EU versus American farming.
Okay.
Stay tuned. Apple.
and this one is called Dues Paid by RecTech. This is HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We will be right back.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Culture City, a for-purpose organization that provides a place of acceptance and support for all autism families. This is Culture City's founder, Julian Maha.
Culture City was really born out of necessity. You know, it was born when my, currently six-year-old boy was diagnosed with autism. His name is Abram and he's nonverbal. And even though my wife and I were both physicians at the time, it was really hard for us to find any resources at that point to help him. All the other organizations out there that we know of, they do phenomenal work, but their main focus is basically finding a cure for autism. Our main focus is basically trying to prepare the community to accept not only children with autism, but their families as well. You know, in addition to that, we also want to provide help to these families in the here and now. You know, so tangible things like, you know, iPads for nonverbal kids, you know, financial scholarships, therapy scholarships, you know, art camps, and also some lecture series that can teach parents about, you know, dietary issues, you know, how to financially plan and things like that.
For more information, visit culturecity.org.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and my guest today is John Wilkes. John is something of an expert on farming, having grown up in a farm in Shropshire. We're talking about the differences between European Union, United Kingdom agriculture, livestock agriculture, and American livestock agriculture. But we're just before the break, we were segueing into a more substantive discussion about a trade agreement that is in the process of negotiation. Now, I know most Americans were well aware of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and people had strong opinions about that. But I dare say that very few Americans have honed in on the TTIP, as it's called, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. John actually was the one who clued me into this. I hadn't really read anything about it. I'd sort of seen it, but hadn't really checked it out. And it was really interesting because some of the same objections that we had in the United States over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, particularly in regards to agriculture and, you know, lowering the bar and undercutting pricing and so forth, are exactly the things that Europeans are terribly worried about in terms of doing trade with the United States. Why don't you go over some of the biggest issues that people seem to have with the TTIP from your side of the pond?
Right.
Because obviously our side of the pond is going to make out like a bandit here.
Well, I think, you know,
the, as usual. Yeah.
Well, you may say that. I couldn't possibly comment. that's a famous line from another TV thing. But anyway, basically, in on the good side, okay, plus minus, you in Europe, there's, you know, there'd be an extra, basically 400,000 jobs being created. I mean, we're talking a big chunk of change here.
But why do they say? Because I actually watched a really interesting video with the trade minister, who's the chief negotiator for this. Of course, the name of his name eludes me. But yes, he was bandying about this, you know, 400,000 plus jobs. Why are those? Why is that going to happen? What are these jobs about? Because there's going to be greater exports.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking to cut down. You know, to get rid of tariffs and to make the, you know, to make trading and regulatory barriers to all kind of disappear or to be more manageable and to cut the paperwork for companies wanting to export. And I mean, it's a big chunk of change. It's worth, I mean, it would be worth, I think it's worth about 119 billion to the EU annually, mm-hmm. and about, I don't know, 95 billion to the US. And we're talking a big chunk. It's about half of the value of the TPP. So uh-huh. it's not, you know, it's not in the same ballpark in that sense. But it's a very close market, and it's a very easy market to get into. I think the jobs would come in because agriculture. We're kind of talking farming here.
Yeah.
This is across a whole sector of jobs. You know, you can
yeah,
buy
of course.
You can buy a Wheezy Volkswagen.
Yeah.
But don't have the windows open when you drive it. Now, because you get gassed.
Or just keep an oxygen tank in the car.
The worry is, I think, that the perception is from some of the stronger countries. But it's Germany, basically, I think, that where the biggest worries are. The workers' rights, you know, U.S. wages are 20% less than EU workers.
Yeah.
And pay and conditions and things like that. So that is a big driver for basically some states to be resisting TTIP. But food is very much in there.
Sure.
And I think if they did do it, that imports from the US would be up 120% into the UK if it was done carte blanche across the board now. So it's a big deal.
Well, they're letting, I mean, for example, one of the things that seems to be really worrying people is importing food from the United States, which obviously would be a lot cheaper than what you produce domestically, thanks to our agribusiness here. And one of the things that I noted with enthusiasm is that we're already shipping over, our beef, which we typically wash in chlorine, which formerly was banned in the EU. And actually, I wouldn't be surprised if it was banned for other reasons, for instance, drugs and hormones, which you guys don't use. Like, why would you want to accept a supply of products that undermine the quality of your food? That to me was really one of the major issues. I was fascinated by that.
Well, particularly as, and another one of the big things is the labeling issue, they would need to, there's clear labeling. Well, let's face it, if you're in Stuttgart in the old supermarket there and you're seeing a big piece of red meat on a piece of styrofoam with US on it, and it's clearly labeled with the greatest of respect, I don't think it would be... I don't think it would be very big on your shopping list.
Maybe not, because, you guys obviously have a country of origin labeling law. Which we're doing our best to gut here in this country, as I'm sure you know.
Oh, I know. The thing about it is, I think food is about 3% of the whole deal. It's the actual food terms. So a lot of it is other stuff, software and all the rest of it. But it seems to me that the whole thing, Miami, the talks finished recently. Mm-hmm. The whole thing in Europe is kind of pissing people off because it all takes place in secret.
Yes, and that's what made people mad about TPP as well.
Yeah. So nobody knows. There is one place you can go to in Brussels at the EU Parliament where you can book 3 weeks in advance and you can have 2 hours to look at some kind of text that's come through. It's just done so people can't really see what is on the table, I suspect. And that's probably at the base of a lot of people's fears, the fears of the unknown in many ways, when a deal is done and no one's had a chance to perhaps have any input.
Well, if I were living in the European Union and I heard that suddenly we were going to be flooded with American cars, goods, food products, crops, et cetera, I would be quaking in my boots. I mean, because I don't think your exports are going to come anywhere near to equaling our exports to you, if you know what I mean. Like, I think you guys will be buyers of American products. We will not be buyers of European Union products, at least on the food side of it, because you just don't produce enough, right?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, our area of expertise.
So that seems very unfair.
Well, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the ban is actually lifted. Technically, the ban's lifted for UK beef to come to the US. I think I'm right in saying it was lifted in December of last year, I think.
Yeah.
But no one's done it yet. The Irish were going to stick some beef into Boston for obvious reasons.
Right.
So the Irish, they were going to bring it. It's all after the 17 years since the BSE thing, and they were lifting the ban. So beef ain't going to happen because with respect, you've got great beef here, and it's something.
It's better. Can,
well, yeah, you may say that again. I couldn't possibly comment. But, on things like...
No, it is, John.
It's juicy, I know.
It's great. I mean, if you're going to buy beef, American beef is really pretty damn good. You may not like the way it's raised. You may not like all the chemicals. Good. But the reality is...
It's good.
Frickin' tasty. Yeah,
man. It goes down. It's lip-schmacking good.
It's lip-schmacking.
Mm-hmm. Lip-schmacking. But no, the thing is, with the sheep side of things, I could see a market here for UK lamb to possibly take on. I mean, the Aussies basically supply, well, and certainly the New Zealands to an extent. So half of the lamb, the 0.8 of a pound that's eaten here per head per person per year, half that's coming from Australia.
Right.
And so I could see the UK being a very much a competitor for the Australian on the sheep side of things, mm-hmm. but certainly in relation to beef, it would be a tall order. You've got Scotch beef, which is a very highly regarded sort of branding. Within the UK, Scotch beef is always considered to be very, very good and highly expensive. And you could get that, I suspect you'd see that in the home of the shiny apple, or Whole Foods, as I like to call it.
Wow.
And, you could see some branding of some high-end product coming in, but certainly not, I wouldn't say commercial stuff.
Yeah, get closer to your phone, John. You're fading out.
okay.
Environmental goals were apparently gutted. Evidently, in the in whatever redacted version of this, it was noted by The Guardian that a lot of the environmental laws that are in place in the United Kingdom and in the European Union have basically been ignored in terms of ignored or just simply dispensed with.
Yes.
Well, that doesn't seem like a good thing. I mean.
Well, they're laying the groundwork, aren't they? Let's be honest. If you think about it, it's not rocket science. If these talks are taking place and there could be issues in relation to GMOs, and now, because what they've done is each country, each of the 29 countries wanted the ability to be able to basically nix any GMOs being grown in their country. But what's happened is the European Parliament have turned round and they've issued a decree that won't work. It's not feasible. And so therefore, that's out of play. So that's got people a bit concerned in that the Parliament has voted, and they voted very heavily, like 500-30 against, that should be the case, that there shouldn't be each country. The Scots, bless them, fired it up in the summertime that they were going to start and become GM-free.
Uh-huh.
And other countries fell in line behind them, the usual suspects. To sort of, jump on that bandwagon.
Well, the French have never allowed GM crops to be grown in France, as far as I know, and I don't think Germany has either.
They had a go once. The what they did was with the GMO. There is in Europe. You see, there is a one crop can be grown in Europe, can be cultivated. It's a maize from Monsanto.
And, nice one.
Sorry, Monsanto.
They're not listening, don't worry.
They don't listen.
They haven't stuck any pins in my voodoo
doll. There's about, and this maize, actually, in Spain, you see, they grow about 340,000 acres of this
of BT corn?
Crop. Yep. Mm-hmm. It's Mon 810, which is the only crop that is actually certified to be grown in Europe. And actually, the French, you see, between you and me, there's no French people listening, so we can talk. they kind of allowed a modified potato, apparently, back in about 2008.
No kidding.
Yeah, kind of. And then we have got the potato. It is GMO. Quick, take it away. No one will know. So anyway, they pulled it off and took it out. So people have toyed with it, but I think there was such a stink kicked up in the late sort of 2002, 2007 and 8 when they played with it, that only Spain have actually, gone ahead and are growing it to any. I think it's like 1.6% of the whole EU maize crop is actually GM, and that's the crop in Spain.
Wow! But I mean, at this point, the Spanish will probably do anything in order to generate some income. I mean, I would be planting every inch of my country with whatever they told me to, as long as I was able to issue a paycheck here and there. One of the other things I read was a campaign group says a report in a U.S. journal concerning these talks show that Europe is already capitulating to huge pressure from the U.S. to allow imports.
What other things
were banned and are now being, besides our chlorine washed beef loaded with ractopamine and hormones?
What other stuff's banned?
Yeah, food. Let's keep it with food products, because it's Heritage Radio Network.
Your chicken is just, I mean, in relation to ag.
Yeah.
Direct consumption stuff would be, your chicken, your beef, and your pork. That pretty well wraps it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, pretty well does, right?
Katie, what I want to talk about is GIs.
GIs?
Yes.
What'd that be?
GIs, geographic indications or geographic. It's this issue of, and it's this.
Sure, you mean like appellation contrôlée, or you know, like one of the like domain, you know, whatever. Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's hear about it.
Well, here's the thing, and this is where the whole deal could founder on the altar of we don't want it. Because basically, geographic indications, GIs, and as you just talked about, it's what protects your cheese, your wines,
or your whatever. Yeah, champagne.
And of course,
yeah.
Yeah. And there is actually a body in the United States called the Consortium for Common Food Names. Did you know that?
I did not. I'm going to write it down.
And I had a chat with Shauna Morris, who's their senior director, and they are very much involved at the moment because there's a feeling here that because Munster cheese is produced here, or versions of Parmigiano Reggiano's are produced here. So, you see, that won't be able to be sold into Europe as it stands, because there's this kind of idea of the GI is a really at the core of many people's objections to things, because it's the kind of classic, Americans coming over here and bringing their stuff that isn't actually from wherever it should be. And I think it's probably one of the biggest niggles.
But, I mean, it seems to me that should just fall into, why can't you still export your product with the GI? Like, I don't get why that's going to be a sticking point. I mean, I can understand how an American American version of Reggiano Parmigiano might not be what Reggiano Parmigiano is, but they're never going to label it Reggiano, right?
Yeah, well, but the thing is, I suspect it's about confusion and the way things are, and the way things are labeled, and you know that your average punter might get confused as to what they're buying, and I suspect they would look on it as the thin end of the wedge, and over time it would be eroded, and it would get worse. I know I was talking to a guy up in Wisconsin who's a big cheesist.
Yeah.
And he's got a big cheese company, and he actually went over in 2011, and he took his Parmigiano Reggiano way over there, and he kicked the Europeans' ass. Actually, he beat them at it, and he got sued by the World Cheese Federation because he'd gone over and beaten them. It was great.
Come on,
yes,
get out of here.
He got sued because he
produced a Parmigiano, but maybe he was calling it the wrong name. I mean,
exactly. They got sued.
Oh, so he shouldn't be calling it Parmesan or Parmigiano.
Well, exactly, and I think that's what it was. He went to the World Cheese Championships, and he got he had a big win, and it all got pretty ugly, and there was threats of court cases, and goodness knows what.
Wow, how interesting! There's a lot to this GI stuff. I mean, I am personally very sympathetic with it. I mean, I think that it's great to have that sort of patrimony when it comes to identifying food products that are traditional and go back hundreds, if not thousands, of years, and you know, to tip the hat towards the producer and the region and all that jazz. I would never want to give that up. I mean.
No.
I hope that the Europeans stay firm on that. There was another comment that I believe was in The Guardian about this. It said the TTIP is already letting big business take over our legislative system. It's about forcing governments to see the whole of society from the viewpoint of big business. Every regulation which is important to the society, workers' rights, or environmental protection becomes simply an obstacle to profit.
Here's the kicker. ISDS.
What's that?
ISDS is Investor State Dispute Settlement. And this is built into the agreement.
Oh, yeah, I read about that.
Oh, this is the doozy. So this is where, if you're a big company who will remain nameless, and you are perceived to be slighted by a country in Europe, that you can't develop your business there successfully, and yada, 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 you're not going to go before a court of law, a legal court on this. You're going to go in front of a panel.
Huh.
Who will decide if that country has been unfair, that government has been unfair in discriminating against you and your product, and give you a big chunk of cash.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of, I think, you know, that's one of the also, that's getting a lot of alarm bells ringing, in that this idea of big companies will get, I mean, I think that's what a lot of people with the TPP talks were against as well.
Yes.
The idea that corporate takeover of trade, you know, they become the regulators and they set the parameters. And I think that's a big issue, possibly.
I think that's a huge issue. I mean, to me, that's sort of like the issue, actually, is, you know, that they're sort of creating almost like a, I mean, you referred to a shadow government and talking about your, what do you call it? Not your dominant party, but your...
Yeah, the party in waiting, they'd like to call it.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I mean, to me, that's what's happening, is that there is like this other body that is being formed with all of these trade partnerships where, you know, normal judicial channels are going to be basically bypassed in favor of these, you know, sort of underground panels as you discuss them. There was one more thing we have to go. Oh, actually, we have to go. We have to
wrap
up. We
got to go?
Yeah, I know. This sucks.
Darn.
This is really fun, John.
We haven't even talked about hot dogs yet.
I know. Or bullfighting. I really wanted to get that proprietary information about the bull breeding subsidies.
Bull breeding. I can talk to you again about bull breeding.
Okay, well, we'll do that. Let's do that. Let's actually write an article or something about it. I think that's a fascinating subject. I mean, I lived in Spain when I was a little girl, and we went to the bullfights a lot, and I thought they were just fabulous. And when I came home, my mother made my brother and me capes and gave us the whole rig, you know, we had the hats and everything. And now I just think, oh my God,
it's a moot point. It's a moot point and a big one, but I make no comment other than that I'd like to make a comment, but we'll do it again.
Okay, we'll do it again. So do you have any, first of all, what is your Twitter feed, dude? Do you have a Twitter handle?
Not particularly huge. I'm a Luddite.
So you don't have that? You don't do Twitter?
I have a Twitter feed which I can give to you, and you can put up on the page for anything.
Well, I'm gonna publicize it right now. What is your Twitter handle?
It's secret, and I'll tell you later.
Okay. All right then. Well, and do you have anything else you want to promote? Is the Livestock Conservancy the same thing as the American Livestock Breed Conservancy?
Big up Livestock Conservancy. Yes.
Big up.
Big up. Yes, that's popular youth speak. Big up.
Yeah. I don't speak that way.
In Santa Rosa this coming week is the Livestock Conservancy Conference, where we're heading out to the West Coast. And it's a great organization, which I am proudly on the board of. And it was a big honor when they asked me as a Brit to come on the board.
Awesome.
We've got that in Santa Rosa.
Even though you abandoned those heritage breeds while you were a farming lad.
Well, exactly. Bigger,
oh my God!
Leaner.
I hope they know
not?
That. Well, John, we have to wrap it up because now I have to say the various things like who my sponsor was and my music and stuff. But I thank you so much for joining me. I hope we can do this again.
We will. We'll have.
Yeah, I like having these European versus American because globalization of food trade is going to be an increasingly large part of all of our lives. So it's always good to get somebody else. Anyway, my producer today, of course, was myself. My engineer, the one and only Jack Inslee, my most beloved pal.
The legendary
Jack Inslee. Absolutely. The one and only. My break music today was provided by Rec Tech, also a favorite. And the theme song to my show is Dead Stars. My sponsor was Culture City. Next up, you're going to be listening to a short clip of A Taste of the Past by the legendary Linda Palacio. But I also want to say, listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. And remember that if you liked what you heard and want to hear more, tell your friends to subscribe to this show and all of the other shows on iTunes or on Stitcher. Is that no longer part of our thing? I don't see it. Anyway, and feel free to get in touch with us at heritageradionetwork.org. You can go to my show page, because I have one, and you can put comments on it. You can also go to my Facebook page, which is What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights with Katie Kiefer. And you can tweet to me. I've never yet revealed my Twitter handle on my show, and it's long past time. It is @KCorrigan, K, think of Wrong Way Corrigan. A tip of the hat to me Irish roots. And I thank you once again, John, for being on the show. And we'll see you next week, folks. Thanks for listening.
A pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It wasn't really until the 1960s, particularly the 1970s, that they took off. And I have a theory about this, which has to do with the fact that donuts do well in times of economic crisis. Mm. So that if you look at the Depression, donuts were big. If you look at the 1970s, donuts were big. And if you look at the first decade or last maybe 10 years when we've been in this economic crisis, right? Once again, donuts become huge.
In episode 178 of A Taste of the Past, Michael Crandall talks about how and why the donut has remained a top-selling dessert, even in tough economic times.
So they take off in the 1970s, and Dunkin' Donuts becomes by far the biggest chain.
Well, and then, as I mentioned earlier, suddenly, I don't know,
everything becomes the new darling. You know, the cupcake became the new craze, much attributed possibly to, you know, the television show Sex and the City.
Oh, absolutely.
Trends.
I think that's right.
And then donuts suddenly, you know, they never went away. They've always been around. But all of a sudden, they became this new craze with odd flavors, exotic flavors, any flavor you can imagine. And donut shops, fancy donut shops, if you will, popping up all over the place, small ones. You know, artisanal donuts. Once
yeah,
I it's think, it's a what do you attribute to that?
Well, I do think that part of it has to do with the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. I do think that has something to do with it. Mm-hmm. Donuts, like a cupcake, is an affordable treat. But I think there's something else about donuts. Donuts have a kind of a street cred that cupcakes will never have.
If you want to learn more about the history of food, check out A Taste of the Past every Thursday at noon, and available all times at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.